The Tom Woods Show, episode 2055.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, a lot of your friends believe that deregulation caused the financial crisis of 2008 just as fervently as they believe that lockdowns are the solution to COVID-19. For the sake of our future, both of these ideas need to be smashed, so check out my free ebook, The Deregulation Boogeyman, over at regulationmyths.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. This is an appearance that I made recently on the Free America Now podcast, hosted by the great former Maine State Senator Eric Brakey, who is also senior spokesperson for Young Americans for Liberty. He's a great guy, and it's always great to talk to him. So we talked a little bit about the days of the Ron Paul Revolution, which was a lot of fun to revisit, but there's plenty to talk about with current events as well. And I so enjoyed the conversation that I thought, doggone it, this is an episode of The Tom Woods Show. So check out Free America Now with Eric Brakey. I was the guest on the 100th episode of Free America Now. So that was a real delight. And I hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed recording it. Here we go.
Hello and welcome everyone to episode 100 of the Free America Now podcast. I am, as always, your host and renegade statesman, Eric Brakey. I am very excited to welcome to the show our mystery guest, the great Tom Woods, sometimes known as a very failed podcaster and New York Times bestselling author. That's only if you ask Michael Malice. We're going to be talking today about the last 10 years since the end of the Ron Paul 2012 presidential campaign and what the Ron Paul Revolution has been up to over these last 10 years and what the future might look like. Hey, Tom, welcome to Free America Now.
Thank you, Eric. Glad to be here.
Well, hey, the pleasure's all mine. I know episode 100 is nothing compared to, I know you recently celebrated your 2000th episode of the Tom Woods Show, which I was happy to be at in person in Florida, watching you get sawed in half and Ron Paul rule that it was an acceptable, that you getting sawed in half was acceptable under the non-aggression principle. That was a fun event. How was it hitting 2000 episodes?
Well, first of all, let me say 100 episodes is nothing to shake a stick at because there is, this might be legendary or apocryphal, but I've heard that the median number of episodes of a podcast is 7, that most people just give up. So if you get past even 7, you have a good chance of having some longevity. So you're way past 7. So no shame in it at all. You got 3 digits. That's fantastic. But look, 2000 episodes really is ridiculous. I mean, it's partly that I decided I wanted to do an every single weekday libertarian podcast. And this was back when there were not as many libertarian podcasts as there are today. But there certainly weren't any that were doing Monday through Friday. And that's why I decided to do it. No one's doing it. And that's why I want to do it. And I feel like over the course of those episodes, I think I've covered a lot of topics that have helped libertarians to learn a lot of things, learn them better, learn how to communicate our ideas more effectively, challenged us to some extent. I've hosted a number of debates on the show that I think have been very productive and not full of venom or animosity, but really a genuine desire to see the world more clearly. So I look back on it and I'm very, very pleased. And now I'm already, just before I talked to you, I just wrapped up episode 2053. We are rolling right along here, Eric.
You know, what I love about your show, Tom, is I never quite know exactly what I'm going to get. I mean, there's a lot of great shows out there where it'll be, you know, the same people talking about current events and what's happening in the news. And that's all well and good. I love those shows.
Yeah, me too.
But with your show, it's one day we could be talking about, like, you know, the history of the Federal Reserve in the 1800s. The next day we're talking about COVID lockdowns. The next day we're talking about, I don't know, why Florida is such a nice state to live in.
I had somebody to, because there are a lot of people thinking of relocating. So I did an episode on the pros and cons of Florida with somebody who knows the ins and outs of all the different parts of Florida and the little subcultures like the back of his hand. Or just today, episode 2053, I just mentioned, I just had a libertarian city council member on where their city council was actually talking about, just because of a peculiarity of what was going on in Minnesota, they were talking about the subject of pain medication and pain management and people with chronic pain and the opioid crisis. Because what's happened is people who suffer from chronic pain, and you, if you haven't suffered from chronic pain, you have no idea what it's like. If I have a little pain, I'm insufferable.
Yeah.
But these are people who all day, every day, even while they're trying to go to sleep, are suffering from chronic pain that nobody knows what to do about. The problem is they haven't been able to get the medications they need because of the emphasis on we don't want people overdosing and adding to the opioid crisis. Well, it turns out that whole way of looking at the question is all wrong, but the human wreckage of it is just overwhelming, that people are suffering needlessly because of this. And this city council member stood up at this meeting and gave an unbelievable PowerPoint presentation with facts and charts and history and unbelievable job that nobody would go to the trouble to do at a city council meeting. So I said, I got to talk to this person. So I just love that every day people aren't expecting me necessarily to talk about what was in the headlines yesterday morning. Sometimes I do that. But it's called the Tom Woods Show because it's what Tom Woods is interested in. And that's different all the time. I have a wide range of interests. And I like to think they overlap with those of my listening audience. But yeah, you're right. I mean, that is really what I'm trying to do, is keep people on their toes. There's a huge range of things we can be talking about as libertarians. There's history, there's economics, there's philosophy, I suppose sociology, psychology. There's so much we can talk about, and practical applications. So sometimes I get people saying, how do you not run out of topics? And I think, what are you talking about? Yeah. I'm never going to run out of topics, because there is always current events as a last resort, but I get so many great suggestions. There are so many interesting people I want to talk to. That's another great thing about having a show. There's somebody I want to talk to. Well, I don't know if they'll necessarily have a colloquy with me online, but if I say, come on my show, they'll come on, then I can talk to them.
Yeah, that's how I get to have a nice long conversation with Tom Woods.
Oh, get out of town. You can call me anytime you want, but I get the point.
Absolutely. Well, I'll look forward to hearing that episode on opioids and prescription drugs, because I know that issue very well. Actually, my state, Maine, I think was one of the first states to push and pass one of these policies restricting what doctors could prescribe on prescription opioids to people. And I was the only person in the entire legislature to vote against it, because wow, everyone was saying, there's an opioid crisis, we've got to do something. And very few people, they just want to look like they're doing something without actually asking, is this going to help? Or is this going to make things worse? Because yeah, of course, there's no plan for those who are addicted to prescription opioids beyond just cutting them off. Well, what's going to happen? Well, these people who have real chronic pain, who are, you know, dependent on these opioids, maybe we could have done something earlier on in the beginning. Maybe medical cannabis would have been better for them than opioids. Who knows? But there's no plan for what you're going to shift them to. We're just cutting them off. And so people are turning to street drugs. People are turning to, you know, much more dangerous than that. You don't know what you're putting into your
right,
system.
Right. I guarantee you that the answer most people are going to give to that who are suffering from chronic pain is not, okay, I guess I'll just tolerate pain every second of my existence. That is the one thing you can know absolutely for sure they're not going to say.
Right. Right. But these are oversimplified answers from politicians who just want to. It's the same thing we've been dealing with COVID, right? A lot of politicians who just want to, we see a problem, people are afraid of a problem, and it's a real problem. And the politicians have to look like they're doing something. And rarely do we go back and ask ourselves, did those things that they did they actually help? Or did they make things worse? Because our history tells us politicians usually make things worse.
Right. Why are you pouring gasoline on that fire? I have to do something. But I just don't think that's the right way. Yeah. Unfortunately, everybody has this feeling that action is always better than inaction. Not necessarily. Not necessarily.
Well, let's hop into, I guess, the primary topic we're going to be talking about today. And I know you were speaking about this recently. I think you emceed an event with the Mises Institute in Texas, honoring 10 years since the end of the Ron Paul 2012 presidential campaign. I recently wrote an op-ed on this about all the liberty movement has accomplished in those 10 years. And I thought this might be an interesting kind of moment on episode 100 to reflect on where the liberty movement has come from and where we're going. You know, after 2012, you know, Ron Paul lost the Republican nomination to Mitt Romney, who all the establishment told us was, you know, the great conservative champion who is going to somehow restore America against Barack Obama, even though you look at, you know, where they stood on the issues. It's hard to see much daylight between the two of them. But, you know, it would have been easy to say the Ron Paul revolution was done at that moment. Ron retired from Congress, went back home, but his supporters kept going to him and asking, Ron, we want to continue the revolution. What can we do? And Ron, being no central planner, said, I don't know. You got to figure it out for yourself. You got to find your own path. And a lot of people did. People running for state legislature, to people pioneering Bitcoin, to people homeschooling their kids and teaching the next generation the principles of liberty. People have been busy. I'm curious for, I guess, kind of your general, just big picture take on the last 10 years and what the Ron Paul revolution has been up to.
Okay, well, a couple things immediately occur to me. A point that I have made now two or three times in public speaking is that when we look at what we've been enduring since 2020, it's hard to believe it's still going on. And now people are walking around. Somebody today is calling them bird people because they're wearing these, they look like beaks, the kind of masks they're wearing. So we're calling them bird people. At this point, I'm no longer, well, you know, they've been manipulated by the media and they don't know any better. No. You've got to be responsible for yourself. And if you're still going for this crazy nonsense now, I'm going to call you a bird person. I mean, if that's the worst thing that happens to you, you know, you're going to be okay. But what I've been saying is that when we look at the two elected officials in the U.S. government who have been the most effective and outspoken and fearless on the COVID matter, it's Rand Paul, without a doubt. There's no, Nobody would have had the guts to stand up to Dr. Fauci if Rand hadn't done so first, because Dr. Fauci is the officially rolled out expert. We're all supposed, he doesn't care about stuff like that. So Rand and Thomas Massie in the House. And both of those are products of the Ron Paul revolution, and they both happen to be the best. I mean, Rand is a direct biological result of the Ron Paul revolution, but that is very significant. And it ties into the second point I want to make, which is the experiences of the 2008 and 2012 campaigns should have been an educational moment for the run-of-the-mill GOP grassroots people. I mean, these were people who were not that unhappy to vote for Romney. I mean, yeah, they would have preferred this one or that one, but they're going to vote for Romney and be more or less content. This was an opportunity for them to learn something they just didn't learn, and it took them until 2020 to finally learn it. What Ron was implicitly teaching them was that the establishment of both parties does not have your best interests at heart. And they just couldn't hear. All they could hear is, we've been told this Ron Paul fellow is a real troublemaker and we don't like him. Why? He's a crank. He should be more like, whatever, Mitch Daniels or something. I mean, okay, that's what they were told. They should have been able to see through that. Because the people who told them that, the people who dissuaded them from listening to Ron Paul because he's a crank and you have to be respectable and not hold these crazy opinions, we don't have any idea why he holds them. These are the same people who, in the GOP, have helped to ruin their lives with the COVID restrictions that 85% of them to 95% of them all went along with. So Mitt Romney being in charge in 2020 wouldn't have been any different, would have been worse, would have been much worse, because he would have been 100% Fauci, whereas Trump was only 68% Fauci. And so when you observed in 2008 and 2012, the blackout of Ron Paul by the mainstream media, that you as a Tea Party person, you as a grassroots Republican, you're supposed to dislike and be suspicious of the media, when they're all telling you, don't listen to that guy, that should make you curious about that guy. But instead, they all just got right in line, like, yep, okay, we won't. Okay, thanks for telling us. Okay, that was an opportunity for you to prepare yourselves for 2020. For when push comes to shove, these people will stick the knife right in your backs, just like any Democrat. The establishment of the party. That's going to happen to you. And it did happen. And guess who the guy who has been 100% sound and solid, defending sanity, rationality, and the people's liberties through this whole ordeal has been? Oh, guess who? Guess who? Ron Paul, the crank nobody's supposed to listen to. So somebody is owed a huge, maybe millions of apologies from people who should have known better. Now, you may say to me, Woods, it's petty of you at a time like this to be demanding apologies. And I get that. I realize that a sincere apology is one of the rarest things in the world, okay? It's rarer than that upside-down airplane stamp that every stamp collector wants to get. You almost never get a sincere apology from anybody. But in principle, they should be saying, we should have known. The way they were going after you and the way you were talking about things that no focus group would ever tell you to talk about, but you just thought they were important, so you didn't care about focus groups. These things should have made us wake up and say, we should listen to this guy, and we're sorry we didn't, because look at the mess we've made by not listening.
Sometimes I look back and I think that 2012 was one of the last exit ramps we had off of this road to serfdom that we've been on. And we're going to go through probably some really hard times in the future as we try to hopefully, you know, get some semblance of freedom and liberty back in America. But I want to mention, you know, you talk about Senator Rand Paul and of course, Congressman Thomas Massie, who have both been, you know, right out of the liberty movement, right out of the Ron Paul movement. I mean, Thomas Massie, not having the family connection to the Pauls, is someone who's very much inspired by the liberty message, like so many people across the country who've continued carrying that torch. But I know that Rand, in the aftermath of the Ron Paul 2012 campaign and leading into 2016, there was a lot of skepticism about Rand Paul. And some of it we could say was deserved. You know, Rand certainly tried to moderate his tone a little bit to try to, you know, bring in a bigger coalition. And of course, what ended up happening is that created an opportunity for Trump to get in and take the anti-establishment vote away from Rand in the 2016 primaries. And of course, Rand, the establishment was never going to go for Rand anyway. So he ended up kind of performing not even nearly as well as his father did. But I think in the years since then, there tends to be an acknowledgement as we've seen Rand fighting Fauci and also being unapologetic in his opposition to the warfare state, where sometimes people felt like he pulled his punches in the past. He seems to have really, in my mind, matured a lot in his position as a U.S. senator since he was elected in 2010. And he seems to be becoming, I guess, the real man in the U.S. Senate that we really have needed in these times that we're in. Do you think that's a proper assessment?
I do. I think he's been outstanding. And I was somebody who was critical early on just because I thought, we had all this energy coming out of the Ron Paul revolution. We're not going to maintain that by playing it safe. Sometimes you got to take risks. And I just thought it was too bland. The delivery was too bland. It was too, I'll go this far and no farther. And I understand that sometimes you have to know where your audience is. I get that. But Ron was very good at that. He would go to an evangelical conference and he wouldn't say, boy, you people are all a bunch of statists. You don't understand anything. He wouldn't talk like that. He would say, all right, well, let me look at what it is you believe and show you how it fits like a glove into what I believe. And then he could go to, some kind of druggie convention or whatever. And that also fits like a glove because people can flourish under a regime of freedom and they can have whatever they want under that kind of regime. And so he can talk in that way. But Rand, my gosh, has he been solid. And so I'm not going to say I take back my criticisms because I think they were sound at the time. But I think I've more than made up for them with what I've written about him and promoted what he's been doing. And honestly, I think he has given other people in public life the courage to stake out positions they wouldn't have taken otherwise. And isn't it interesting that even Trump himself, who's supposed to be Mr. Tough Guy got taken for a ride by Fauci himself. And yeah. Mr. Tough Guy thought the governor of Georgia was opening up too soon. And Mr. Tough Guy said that Thomas Massie's being too tough on the budget and too demanding, whatever. No, maybe it's that you're not the tough guy. Maybe you have a lot of exterior bravado, but these are the tough guys. I mean, these are the ones who actually, when the chips are down and the really, really unpopular decision has to be made, they'll make it.
Yeah. And sometimes I look back at the years that we've been in, and it seems like this was the perfect time for Rand Paul to be president. I mean, if we had a president who understood the system, who understood medicine, who could have, from a place of authority, called out Anthony Fauci's BS and frankly fired the guy. And instead, we had Donald Trump, who had some good instincts on things, but never really seemed to have a very solid worldview and seemed to be able to be led around by the nose by neocons who would sing his praises to his face and then stab him in the back when he wasn't looking. So anyway, that's...
Well, I personally think it would have been great to see the kinds of press conferences he would have had, the people he would have brought in. I mean, Scott Atlas is great, and I had a great interview with him on the Tom Woods Show, but he was brought in too late. And yeah. I just would have liked to see at these press conferences, I want to see chart after chart after chart. Here's a state that did X. Here's a state that did not do X. How come they look exactly the same? Just over and over and over and over. Because most people are not going to read very deeply. But if they see charts again and again and again and again, indicating that these interventions that are ruining their lives and decimating their savings and splitting their families apart aren't accomplishing anything, that's going to sear its way into their brains. And so that would have been nice to see. Also, though, I have to say there is a part of me that can understand on a human level, at least, why Trump did what he did. That nobody's really been in this kind of position before.
Yeah.
And nobody really knew how this virus behaved or what to expect. And he has to know that every single death, if he doesn't do something, quote unquote, will be attributed to him. Now, of course, every death was attributed to him no matter what they did, no matter how extreme it got. But to immediately dismiss the man who has been in one presidential administration after another as the expert, I mean, the screams, you would have had to have a backbone made out of some kind of steel we haven't invented yet to actually have the guts to do that. I think there are very, very few people with that kind of level of guts.
Yeah, and certainly we know that what you say is true because we can see it in the states. You know, Ron DeSantis is blamed for every single COVID death in Florida, but Gavin Newsom isn't blamed for every single COVID death in California, even though the death rate in California is higher than the death rate in Florida, because Gavin Newsom is seen as doing something, even if those things are counterproductive.
Yeah, I'd have to check the numbers recently. I'm not quite sure that that's still the case, but if you do age-adjusted mortality, they are pretty darn close, we can say that. And that's the only measure that matters, is age-adjusted. Because obviously, if you have a very young state like California and a very old state like Florida, you can't just compare them because that's apples to oranges. There are some comparisons you can make and some that are not legit. Like, for example, they always want to compare the U.S. to New Zealand. But you can't, for some reason, compare Sweden to Belgium. That's absolutely not allowed. Sweden is only allowed to be compared to Denmark for some reason. You know, so sometimes it's legit to say it's not a good comparison, and other times they're just covering themselves when they say that.
Hey, folks, as part of my sponsor message for BitTrust IRA, let me tell you what I gave two of my daughters for Christmas this year. I gave each of them 1/100th of a Bitcoin. Now, if you don't know about Bitcoin, that might not sound like a lot, but these days it kind of is. And I thought that giving them a stake in Bitcoin would be a great way to introduce them to it. And of course, a lot of people have become very interested in Bitcoin, especially over the past several years, and they know they should hold it, but the cryptocurrency world can be confusing. Well, one thing a lot of people have been doing is adding Bitcoin to their retirement accounts. And BitTrust IRA helps you seamlessly and securely add cryptocurrency to your portfolio. BitTrust IRA stores your private keys in nuclear bunkers with military-grade encryption. Plus, they have a 24/7 trading platform with no minimum investments and unlimited trades, plus a team to help guide you along the way if you have any questions. They also offer the lowest trading fees in the industry. Go to bittrustira.com/woods today to learn more. And for a limited time, BitTrust IRA is waiving the sign-up fee for Tom Woods Show listeners. That's a $50 value. That's bittrustira.com/woods. bittrustira.com/woods.
Well, let me ask you, so we're talking about COVID, but let's talk about another, you know, issue that's certainly very much part of the Ron Paul message that has, I think, become a part of the DNA of conservatism, in the sense that you see a lot of people out there these days who are not necessarily people on the right I would identify with and say these are folks who, you know, are libertarians. But on the foreign policy, I hear from this kind of this America First brand of Republicans, I'm thinking like the Matt Gaetzes of the world, these folks, the Tucker Carlsons of the world. Of course, Tucker Carlson did speak at the rally for the Republic. He has some ties to the Ron Paul movement, but he's not. He's kind of his own thing.
Yeah.
But you hear this anti-interventionist strain of foreign policy thought, which was certainly not a part of the Republican Party in any significant way when Ron Paul was running for president. This was exactly what he was dismissed for. You would hear people all the time say, well, I agree with Ron Paul on everything except for that foreign policy stuff. We need to be bombing people in the Middle East and invading countries that, you know, never posed any threat to us. That was the reigning orthodoxy when George W. Bush was in and the neocons were ruling the roost. Now the neocons like Liz Cheney are being pushed out. increasingly they're going over to the Democratic Party, where they're finding the Democratic Party seems to be more in line with their militaristic goals and agendas, whereas the Republican Party doesn't seem to have the same room for them that they did before. Would you agree at least that foreign policy, the Paulist view on foreign policy, seems to have become a part of kind of the conservative DNA and where we are today?
Well, there's certainly a wing of it where you see that happening. I see this all the time. Maybe it's just the people I follow on Twitter. I don't know. But I see a lot of right-wing sentiment about not another war, and no, we're not doing this. We're not going to spend blood and treasure on this, that, and the other thing. And a lot of these up-and-coming young people who are, well, let's say youngish people who are running for office, you do see a cohort of them that is just different from what's gone before. I mean, I think of Anthony Sabatini in Florida. Now, yeah. He's not everybody's cup of tea, and he's very, very blunt. I mean, more so than Trump, I think. But on everything, well, I don't know about everything, because I don't want to say that because I haven't looked into everything, but I know he's much better on the war on drugs, and he's much better on and reliable on foreign policy. Yeah, I'm sure he's got some, you know, right-wingy stuff that I might not like. But if you can't read the room here and read the historical moment we're in, whatever bothers you about Anthony Sabatini doesn't even matter. It has nothing to do with the challenges we're facing right now. You know, if 50 years from now, we can argue about minutiae in his platform. But what matters right now is we're living in a biomedical security state run by lunatics and psychotics, which has made a huge fraction of the American public into unthinking drones. That's kind of the most important thing going on right now. Meanwhile, we have a foreign policy establishment that, you know, has been put under strain, but it has not gone away and still wants to stir up trouble and is looking for some excuse for intervention or sanctions or whatever. These are the issues, for heaven's sake. And we're seeing the results of both, you know, a reckless monetary policy and, of course, supply chain problems caused by the psychotic reaction to COVID coming to roost. That's a major, major problem. Whatever it is that maybe Sabatini says an insensitive word once in a while, I don't even know. Probably he doesn't. But let's say that's the big complaint. I don't even care. Say all the insensitive words you want, because for anybody with a functioning brain, insensitive words is like number 107 right now on our list of concerns. So I agree with you. I see the same trend you see, and it makes me feel like, you know, there's some life in the old thing yet.
Maybe there's some cause for optimism in terms of our foreign policy around the corner with the new generation that's rising up. And it is always sweet for me to see every single day Liz Cheney being drummed out of the party. I don't care. I don't know much about her primary opponent. I know Trump has endorsed her primary opponent, all that. She could be, you know, she could end up being just an establishment shill like all the rest in Washington, D.C. It still is sweet to see Liz Cheney, whose agenda has always been more war at every single turn. It is wonderful to see someone like her be unacceptable to the Republican Party base, because it's a full 180 from where we were 10 years ago.
That supports what I was saying about the establishment. Notice who is boo-hooing this phenomenon. The whole Democratic Party establishment can't believe that the Republican Party doesn't want somebody like Liz Cheney. No. If you were normal and you were the people you claim to be, you would say, well, good for the Republican Party for saying, you know, somebody like you who is a propagandist at a level that would insult a second grader when it comes to fomenting war. Good that they've turned the corner on this. It's about time. You could say, we Democrats have known the truth about the war machine in this country for a long time. No. It's how dare they rise up against Liz Cheney, a great statesman like her. You know, the whole establishment, the media, oh my goodness, poor Liz Cheney. So again, folks, now you see it's the same lesson. In the same way that if they're all boycotting and blacklisting and or denouncing somebody, you have to at least be, it's not 100%. Sometimes they really are rotten people, but a lot of the time they're just decent people being put upon by an evil media and political establishment. But by contrast, when they're all cheering somebody and boo-hoo, and we can't believe the uppity peons have decided they don't need your leadership anymore, then you know that you should be suspicious of that person. I defy anybody to find me an example in the past few years of an actually good politician in the Republican Party who ran into any problems with the grassroots and who was then championed by the media and the Democrats, who was actually a good guy. I defy you to name me such a person.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it's interesting as I reflect back on kind of where the kind of populist political sentiments were, you know, 10 years ago, you know, 2010, 2012. And I have to think even the left was so much better. I mean, when the left was organizing around the idea of Occupy Wall Street, which again, I think they had a lot of mistaken premises, but they were at least responding to a problem that actually mattered, which is the crooked economic system. You know, I think the left oftentimes has the problem they were looking at in the post-meltdown, you know, wrote a book about the post-housing crisis meltdown. They were looking at the problem and saying, this is big corporations' fault, and so we got to go after the big corporations. But at the same time, you had the Tea Party, which was responding to this same problem, the same economic problem, and saying, this is the problem. It's the big government that's doing this to us. We got to restrain the big government. And it's like they both had half the picture when the real problem was it was the big government and the big corporations in bed with each other, creating a system that screws over the rest of us. And if only, like, I look back on that and I think, you know, perhaps there was real opportunity to really go after things like the Federal Reserve. I mean, geez, we got in the House of Representatives at the time, Ron Paul's bill to audit the Fed got passed in the House, got killed in the Senate, hasn't really made progress since then. It seems to me that there has perhaps been a deliberate strategy from, I guess, the establishment in America to distract from those real problems, which the American people were starting to rise up and demand solutions to with identity politics. You know, now we are fighting over just surface level, you know, we don't fight about the wars anymore. As long as we're happy that the CIA is intersectional in its hiring practices for who's pulling the triggers to bomb and murder people halfway across the world. It seems like we've missed the point, and that seems to be the point. People have taken their eye off the real challenges here.
I think it's pretty obvious that any regime wants to see its subject population divided against itself. Why wouldn't they? Because if we think that the real danger is my neighbor down the street, as opposed to Joe Biden, then all the better. Now, by the way, in the age of COVID, maybe it is my neighbor down the street, you know, so it's hard to be dogmatic about this, but something like having them argue about critical race theory or having them argue about pronouns or whatever, regardless of the outcome of that particular debate, the regime is fine. If we're debating where or whether the U.S. government should intervene around the world, well, that's not really a debate they want us having, because that could actually affect them. They don't want public opinion shifting on that, because sometimes public opinion really does make changes in the way things are done. So if, as long as we argue about things that the outcome doesn't matter to the regime, if CRT is in the schools or not in the schools, the regime continues on. Exactly the kind of arguments they want us to have.
Yeah. And it's been pretty successful in that divide and conquer strategy. But I do see, you know, and I know I want to respect your time because there's a few things I wanted to talk about before we finished up. So we talked about the federal level. We've talked about COVID. We've talked about the shifting narrative on foreign policy, the neocons not having the same place in the Republican Party that they used to have. That's all going on the federal level, of course. But there's been a lot going on the state levels. Young Americans for Liberty is elected, you know, nearly 200 kind of Ron Paul-inspired legislators. Anthony Sabatini, who you mentioned, is a member of our Young Americans for Liberty Hazlitt Coalition, one of a few people running for trying to make the jump to the federal level. I've been there before. I know what that's like. So there's progress been made there. You also have, you know, I think about all those folks who Ron Paul talked about ending the Fed. We haven't been able to get a political solution to that. The political system is very, very entrenched for protecting the Federal Reserve. So a lot of people went out and just said, screw it. We're going to start our own parallel financial system, pioneered Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies that have kind of gotten to the point of even Hillary Clinton expressing public comments, concern that these could one day threaten the global reserve status of the U.S. fiat dollar. I'm curious, outside of Washington, D.C. court politics, what do you see the Liberty Movement having accomplished over the course of the last 10 years? And I guess, do you have hope for what comes beyond?
I guess it depends on what we think of as the liberty movement. Do we think of it exclusively in terms of legislative victories, or do we think of it as a cultural or intellectual phenomenon? And I guess there's some, on my part anyway, some frustration that we haven't made more headway. I know that you and I have talked about this before, and you've made a good case that, you know, we have actually changed the conversation on some important things. And that's definitely true. When it comes to foreign policy, we actually have a conversation about it now. It's not just two different interventions we're debating. It's whether or not we should intervene is finally on the table.
It's finally made its way onto the 3x5 card.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And then also monetary policy. So that's those are great things. Secondly, I think people, you know, who, let's say, might have been inclined to look askance at a Ron Paul in 2008, those very people are beginning to get it. Because how could you not? I mean, at this point, I don't mean to be insulting, but unless you're a blockhead, you see something's the matter here. You know, something's the matter with the whole establishment. And just alerting people to that, and the point where now CNN has fewer than a million viewers on any given show, that's unbelievable. I mean, that is a catastrophic collapse. And I think that is part of the legacy of the Ron Paul Revolution. I think the Ron Paul Revolution helped to make the best elements of the right bolder, the best elements, the anti-establishment, anti-media. And it's so funny, by the way, to see people in the left wing of the libertarian movement just huff and puff about how dare Trump say the media is the enemy of the people. No truer thing has ever been said. And it doesn't matter that Trump said it. No truer thing has ever been said. These people are propagandists and liars 24 hours a day. It's incredible. The headlines I read, the headlines are editorializing now. In the headline, like the Neil Young and versus Joe Rogan thing, even the headlines were propaganda about that. They can't even just report that to us. So all of this has definitely been an advance. And certainly we have a good cadre of younger folks who haven't bought into the establishment. But there's just still so many people who want to go along. And you think, remember the old days when it was cool to not go along? Like, when did that go out of fashion? When did now the cool thing be, I'm with the power elite? You know, what?
You know, it is amazing to me to look back and see where we are now. And I think about, of course, we can't even call CNN the mainstream media anymore. They're not mainstream. They are increasingly rejected. People aren't watching. People are turning to different opinion makers. They are turning to Joe Rogan. They are turning to Tucker Carlson, which is interesting to me because, of course, Joe Rogan is someone who endorsed Ron Paul in 2008, or at least in 2012. I can't remember if he did in 2008. Tucker Carlson, you know, emceed part of the rally for the Republic for Ron Paul in 2008. These were both folks who 10 years ago would have been considered on kind of the political fringe. And yet they have the biggest audiences today. And of course, they're also very different politically. I mean, you know, and I think it's also a reminder of kind of what a big tent the Ron Paul Liberty Movement was, that it included Joe Rogan and Tucker Carlson. At least they're very culturally different. You know, Joe Rogan's probably much more of a 1990s liberal, and Tucker Carlson's much more of maybe of a paleo conservative. But
I remember that episode of The Tonight Show where Ron Paul was on and Joe Rogan was also on. He was wearing a Ron Paul shirt.
Yeah.
That was a great moment. Yeah.
And now they're the biggest names in media. It seems to be suggesting that something is changing. The establishment is losing control of the narrative. And what comes next from that perhaps is hard to say, but they are behaving more and more desperate by the day. Let me give you the last word here, because again, I promised I would get you out on time. Last word to share with the audience, and then we'll wrap up, Tom.
All right. Well, I would say, you know, we have the potential to do a lot of interesting things because we, even with the censorship that we observe, and yes, I know it's not technically, you know, I don't want to get into the ins and outs, but we all know that voices are being silenced one way or another. But even with that, we still have the most amazing tools known to man at our fingertips. And incidentally, sites like Odyssey and Rumble are gaining traction, Rumble in particular, as alternatives to YouTube. We have extraordinary tools at our disposal. And it's our own fault if we're spending too much time arguing on Facebook rather than using them. And even something like, I had somebody on my show a month or two ago who is really, really good on TikTok. Now, I'm never, ever going to be on TikTok. There's something that gets into your brain when you reach a certain age that says, I'm just too old for this. I'm never going to learn it. But good luck to those of you who want to use it. TikTok is one of those. And this person had all kinds of best practices to recommend and had great strategies for getting our message out in these super brief but interesting and engaging TikTok videos. Putting his effort into that, and that might seem trivial to some people. It's not. For people who don't read books, that's the thing. That's what reaches them.
And for a lot of Gen Zers,
that's the kind of thing we should put our energy into instead of spinning our wheels on Twitter trying to argue important things in 280 characters.
Yeah.
I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, that's where a lot of the Gen Zers are. And I know I never thought I would be on TikTok, but some of the
Some
of the Gen Zers at Young Americans for Liberty have been teaching me. I'll record like a 1 minute video and then they'll take it and they'll put it on TikTok.
Okay. They know how to TikTokify it and stuff. Okay. That's good.
Yeah. So I'm starting to feel my age at Young Americans for Liberty. It's the first time I've worked a job where I wasn't the youngest person in the room and I'm the old guy, where everyone's asking for the old war stories of
And the word young is staring at you right there from the title, you know, as a rebuke almost.
You know, I had Spike Cohen on, and I think we determined that once you hit 35, which is, you know, the constitutional age to run for president, then that's when you can't call yourself a young American.
So it's been two more years. It's been like forever for me. I'm a middle-ager for liberty.
You know, but hey, Tom, it takes people of all ages.
Even
the old men like you.
That's right. I still vividly recall being in my early 20s and being the youngest person at any of these events. I still vividly recall that. And boy, do I miss those days.
You know, when I was in the state Senate, it was like, I was elected at 26. So like I'm there like mid-20s with a bunch of gray hairs. It was anyway. I know what you mean. Well, hey, we're out of time. Tom, I want to respect your time. Thank you so much for being the mystery guest on our 100th episode. It's a real pleasure. And I'm sure most people who listen to this already know about your show. But in case there is someone who doesn't know, where can people find your show and follow you on social media?
Well, the key thing really would be to go to the show. And I've got tomspodcast.com. as a way to get you right to my list of episodes. And when you look at that list, you're going to find something you want to listen to. And when you click on it, you'll see a way to subscribe to the podcast. And you get something really pretty darn good 5 days a week. It makes you smarter, makes you more informed, better person, I dare say. So tomspodcast.com is the key place to go. I did also, I'm notorious for my mailing list. People say, I don't want any email. I don't want to read email. Yes, you do. Yes, you do. You want to read my email because all your friends are reading it and they're finding stuff out that you're not finding out. And that would be a real shame, wouldn't it? So one way to hop on there would be when you go to tomspodcast.com, right there up on the top of the screen, you know, it says sign me up in a red button. You just click on that baby, get your ad blocker off because I need to have a little box come up so you can enter your email address and you'll be on the best mailing list in the history of mankind. Now, with a slight exaggeration, perhaps.
Well, yeah, when you think about it, actually, the best email list in the history of mankind, that's not a very long history.
A part of why I feel like I can semi-get away with saying that, even though it's not even true there. But think to yourself, what did you pay for it, after all? Right? Even if it disappoints you occasionally, what did you pay for it?
Well, I don't sign up for very many email lists, but this is one that I certainly am on. And hey, Tom, it's a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you to our audience for listening in. Furthermore, my opinion is the Federal Reserve should be destroyed. I will talk with you all tomorrow.
All right, everybody. Let me say one quick thing before we end the episode for today. There was a lot of hoopla around my announcement February 1st, when I told you where I would be making that announcement. But I want to add that there's another important thing that happens February 1st, and that is Veronica Woods turns 17. So I don't want her birthday to be overshadowed by my announcement. So I am officially announcing to the world, happy birthday, Veronica, February 1st, 2022. I hope you have a great day. And as a matter of fact, as soon as I finish recording this message, I'm going to be wrapping your presents, which I should have wrapped
in the days up to now, but I didn't. But I'm going to be wrapping them and handing them to you within the hour. All right, everybody, that's all I have to say. I'll see y'all tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.